"What kind of water?" I asked.
"I don't know,"
said Mr. Honda.
"Water!"
On the TV, some university professor was saying that people's chaotic use of Japanese grammar corresponded precisely to the chaos in their lifestyles.
"Properly speaking, of course, we cannot call it chaos. Grammar is like the air. Someone higher up might try to set rules for its use, but people won't necessarily follow them."
It sounded interesting, but Mr. Honda just went on talking about water.
"To tell you the truth, I suffered over water,"
he said.
"There was no water in Nomonhan. The front line was a mess, and supplies were cut off. No water, no rations, no bandages, no bullets. It was awful. The big boys in the rear were interested only in one thing, seizing territory as fast as possible. Nobody was thinking about supplies. For 3 days, I had almost no water. If you left a flannel out, it'd be wet with dew in the morning. You could wring out a few drops to drink, but that was it. There was no other water at all. I wanted to die. It was so bad. Being thirsty like that is the worst thing in the world. I was ready to run out and stop a bullet. Men who got shot in the stomach would scream for water. Some of them went crazy with thirst. It was a living hell. We could see a big river flowing right in front of us, with all the water anybody could ever drink. But we couldn't get to it. Between us and the river was a line of huge Soviet tanks with flamethrowers. Machine gun emplacements bristled like pincushions. Sharpshooters lined the high ground. They sent up flares at night. All we had was Model 38 infantry rifles and 25 bullets each. Still, most of my buddies went to the river. They couldn't take it. Not one of them made it back. They were all killed. So you see, when you're supposed to stay still, stay still."
He pulled out a tissue, blew his nose loudly, and examined the results before crumpling the tissue and throwing it into the wastebasket.
"It can be hard to wait for the flow to start,"
he said.
"But when you have to wait, you have to wait. In the meantime, assume you're dead."
"You mean I should stay dead for now?" I asked.
"How's that?"
"You mean I should stay dead for now?"
"That's it, son. Dying is the only way for you to float free, Nomonhan."
He went on talking about Nomonhan for another hour. We just sat there and listened. We had been ordered to receive his teaching, but in a year of monthly visits to his place, he had almost never had a teaching for us to receive. He rarely performed divination. The one thing he talked about was the Nomonhan incident, how a cannon shell blew off half the skull of the lieutenant next to him, how he leapt into a Soviet tank and torched it with a Molotov cocktail, how they cornered and shot a downed Soviet pilot. All his stories were interesting, even thrilling, but as with anything else, if you hear them 7 or 8 times, they tend to lose some of their luster. Nor did he simply tell his stories. He screamed them. He could have been standing on a cliff edge on a windy day, shouting to us across a chasm. It was like watching an old Kurosawa movie from the very front row of a rundown cinema. Neither of us could hear much of anything for a while after we left his house. Still, we, or at least I, enjoyed listening to Mr. Honda's stories. Most of them were bloody, but coming from the mouth of a dying old man in a dirty old robe, the details of battle lost the ring of reality. They sounded more like fairy tales.
Almost half a century earlier, Mr. Honda's unit had fought a ferocious battle over a barren patch of wilderness on the Manchurian-Mongolian border. Until I heard about it from Mr. Honda, I knew almost nothing about the Battle of Nomonhan. And yet it had been a magnificent battle. Almost barehanded, they had defied the superior Soviet mechanized forces, and they had been crushed. One unit after another had been annihilated. Some officers had, on their own initiative, ordered their troops to retreat to avoid annihilation. Their superiors forced them to commit suicide. Most of the troops captured by the Soviets refused to participate in the post-war exchange of prisoners because they were afraid of being tried for desertion. These men ended up contributing their bones to the Mongolian earth. Sent home with an honorable discharge, after he lost his hearing, Mr. Honda became a practitioner of divination.
"It was all to the good," he said. "If my hearing hadn't been ruined, I probably would have died in the South Pacific. That's what happened to most of the troops who survived Nomonhan. Nomonhan was a great embarrassment for the Imperial Army, so they sent the survivors where they were most likely to be killed. The commanding officers who made such a mess of Nomonhan went on to have distinguished careers in Central Command. Some of the bastards even became politicians after the war, but the guys who fought their hearts out for them were almost all snuffed out."
"Why was Nomonhan such an embarrassment for the army?" I asked.
"The troops all fought bravely, and a lot of them died, right? Why were the survivors treated so badly?"
But Mr. Honda seemed not to hear my question. He stirred and rattled his divining sticks.
"You'd better be careful of water,"
he said. And so ended the day's session. After my bust-up with Kumiko's father, we stopped going to Mr. Honda's. It was impossible for me to continue visiting him knowing it was being paid for by my father-in-law, and we were in no position to pay him ourselves. We could barely keep our heads above water in those days. In time, we forgot about Mr. Honda, just as most busy young people tend to forget about most old people. In bed that night, I went on thinking about Mr. Honda. Both he and Malta Kano had spoken to me about water. Mr. Honda had warned me to be careful. Malta Kano had undergone austerities on the island of Malta in connection with her research on water. Perhaps it was a coincidence, but both of them had been deeply concerned about water. Now it was starting to worry me. I turned my thoughts to images of the battlefield at Nomonhan, the Soviet tanks and machine gun emplacements, and the river flowing beyond them. The unbearable thirst. In the darkness I could hear the sound of the river.
"Toru," Kumiko said to me in a tiny voice, "are you awake?"
"Uh-huh."
"About the tie. I've just remembered. I took it to the cleaners in December. It needed pressing. I suppose I forgot."
"December?
Kumiko, that's over 6 months ago." "I know. And you know, I never do anything like that, forgetting things. It was such a lovely tie, too."
She put her hand on my shoulder.
"I took it to the cleaners by the station. Do you think they still have it?"
"I'll go tomorrow. It's probably there."
"What makes you think so? 6 months is a long time. Most cleaners will get rid of things that aren't claimed in 3 months. They can do that. It's the law. What makes you think it's still there?"
"Maltacano said I'd find it somewhere outside the house." I could feel her looking at me in the dark.
"You mean you believe what she says?"
"I'm starting to."
"Pretty soon you and my brother might even start seeing eye to eye,"
she said, a note of pleasure in her voice. "We just might," I said. I kept thinking about the Nomonhan battlefield after Kumiko fell asleep. The soldiers were all asleep there. The sky overhead was filled with stars, and millions of crickets were chirping. I could hear the river. I fell asleep listening to it flow.
5. Hooked on lemon drops. Flightless bird and waterless well.
After doing the breakfast dishes, I rode my bike to the cleaners by the station. The owner, a thin man in his late 40s, with deep wrinkles in his forehead, was listening to a tape of the Percy Faith Orchestra on a music machine that had been placed on a shelf. It was a large JVC with some kind of extra woofers attached and a mound of cassette tape standing by. The orchestra was performing Tara's theme, making the most of its lush string arrangement. The owner himself was in the back of the shop, whistling along with the music as he ran a steam iron over his shirt, his movements sharp and energetic. I approached the counter and announced with suitable apologies that I had brought a tie-in late last year and forgotten to pick it up. To his peaceful little world at 9:30 in the morning, this must have been tantamount to the arrival of a messenger bearing terrible news in a Greek tragedy.
"No ticket either, I suppose,"
he said in a strange, distant voice. He was talking not to me, but to the calendar on the wall by the counter. The photo for June showed the Alps, a green valley, cows grazing, a hard-edged white cloud floating against Mont Blanc, or the Matterhorn, or wherever. Then he looked at me with an expression on his face that all but said, "If you were going to forget the damned thing, you should have forgotten it." It was a direct and eloquent look.
"End of the year, huh? That's a toughie. We're talking more than 6 months ago. All right, I'll have a look, but don't expect me to find it."
He switched off his iron, put it on the ironing board, and whistling along with the theme from A Summer Place, started to rummage through the shelves in the back room. Back in senior school, I had taken my girlfriend to see A Summer Place. It starred Troy Donahue and Sandra Dee. We saw it in a rep cinema in a double bill with Connie Francis's Follow the Boys. It had been pretty bad, so far as I could remember, but hearing the music now in a cleaner's, 13 years later, I could recall only good memories from that time.
"A blue polka dot tie?" asked the owner. "Name Okada?"
"That's it," I said.
"You're in luck."
As soon as I got home, I phoned Kumiko at work.
"They had the tie," I said. "Incredible," she said. "Good for you."
It sounded artificial, like praise for a son bringing home good marks. This made me feel uneasy. I should have waited until her lunch break to phone.
"I'm so relieved," she said. "But I've got someone on hold right now. Sorry, could you call me back at noon?"
"That I will," I said. After hanging up, I went out to the veranda with the morning paper. As always, I lay on my stomach with the job ads spread out before me, taking all the time I needed to read them from one end to the other. The columns filled with incomprehensible codes and clues. The variety of professions in this world was amazing, each assigned its place amidst the paper's neat rows as on a graveyard map. As happened each morning, I heard the wind-up bird winding its spring in a treetop somewhere. I closed the paper, sat up with my back against a post, and looked out at the garden. Soon the bird gave its rasping cry once more, a long creaking sound that came from the top of the neighbor's pine tree. I strained to see through the branches, but there was no sign of the bird, only its cry, as always. And so the world had its spring wound for the day. Just before 10, it started to rain. Not a heavy rain. You couldn't really be sure it was raining. The drops were so fine. But if you looked hard, you could tell. The world existed in two states, raining and non-raining, and there should be a line of demarcation between the two. I remained seated on the veranda for a while, staring at the line that was supposed to be there. What should I do with the time until lunch? Go for a swim at the nearby municipal pool? Or to the alley to look for the cat? Leaning against the veranda post, watching the rain fall in the garden, I went back and forth between the two. Pool. Cat. the cat won. Maltacano had said that the cat was no longer in the neighborhood. But that morning, I had an indefinable urge to go out and look for it. Cat hunting had become a part of my daily routine. And besides, Kumiko might be cheered to learn that I had given it a try. I put on my light raincoat. I decided not to take an umbrella. I put on my tennis shoes and left the house with the key and a few lemon drops in my coat pocket. I cut across the yard, but just as I set one hand on the breeze block wall, a phone rang. I stood still, straining my ears. But I couldn't tell whether it was our phone or a neighbor's. The minute you leave your house, all phones sound alike. I gave up and climbed over the wall. I could feel the soft grass through the thin soles of my tennis shoes. The alley was quieter than usual. I stood still for a while, holding my breath and listening. But I couldn't hear a thing. The phone had stopped ringing. I heard no bird cries or street noises. The sky was painted over, a perfect uniform gray. On days like this, the clouds seemed to absorb the sounds from the surface of the earth, and not just sounds, all kinds of things. Perceptions, for example. Hands shoved into the pockets of my raincoat, I slipped down the narrow alley. Where clothes-drying poles jutted out into the lane, I squeezed sideways between the walls. I passed right beneath the eaves of other houses. In this way, I made my silent way down this passage reminiscent of an abandoned canal. My tennis shoes on the grass made no noise at all. The only sound I heard on my brief journey was of a radio playing in one house. It was tuned to a talk show discussing callers' problems. A middle-aged man was complaining to the host about his mother-in-law. From the snatches I caught, the woman was 68 and crazy about horse racing. Once I was past the house, the sound of the radio began to fade until there was nothing left. As if what had gradually faded into nothingness was not only the sound of the radio, but the middle-aged man and his horse-obsessed mother-in-law, both of whom must exist somewhere in the world. I finally reached the vacant house. It stood there, hushed as ever. Against the background of gray, low-hanging clouds, its second-story storm shutters nailed shut, the house loomed as a dark, shadowy presence. It could have been a huge freighter caught on a reef one stormy night long ago and left to rot. If it hadn't been for the increased height of the grass since my last visit, I might have believed that time had stopped in this one particular place. Thanks to the long days of rain, the blades of grass glowed with a deep green luster, and they gave off the smell of wildness unique to things that sink their roots into the earth. In the exact center of this sea of grass stood the bird sculpture, in the very same pose I had seen it in before, with its wings spread, ready to take off. This was one bird that could never take off, of course. I knew that, and the bird knew that. It would go on waiting where it stood until the day it was carted off, or smashed to pieces. No other possibilities existed for it to leave this garden. The only thing moving in there was a small white butterfly fluttering across the grass some weeks out of season. It made uncertain progress like a searcher who has forgotten what he was searching for. After 5 minutes of this fruitless hunt, the butterfly went off somewhere. Sucking on a lemon drop, I leaned against the chain-link fence and looked at the garden. There was no sign of the cat. There was no sign of anything. The place looked like a still, stagnant pool in which some enormous force had blocked the natural flow. I felt the presence of someone behind me and whirled around. But there was no one. There was only the fence on the other side of the alley, and the small gate in the fence, the gate in which the girl had stood. But it was closed now, and in the yard was no trace of anyone. Everything was damp and silent. And there were the smells, grass, rain, my raincoat, the lemon drop under my tongue half-melted. They all came together in a single deep breath. I turned to survey my surroundings once more, but there was no one. Listening hard, I caught the muffled chop of a distant helicopter. People were up there, flying above the clouds. But even that sound drew off into the distance, and silence descended once again. The chain-link fence surrounding the vacant house had a gate, also of chain-link, not surprisingly. I gave it a tentative push. It opened with almost disappointing ease, as if it were urging me to come in. No problem, it seemed to be telling me, just walk right in. I didn't have to rely on the detailed knowledge of the law that I had acquired over 8 long years to know that it could be a very serious problem indeed. If a neighbor spotted me in the vacant house and reported me to the police, they would show up and question me. I would say I was looking for my cat. It had disappeared, and I was looking for it all over the neighborhood. They would demand to know my address and occupation. I would have to tell them I was out of work. That would make them all the more suspicious. They were probably nervous about left-wing terrorists, convinced they were all over Tokyo, with hidden arsenals of guns and homemade bombs. They'd call Kumiko at her office to verify my story. She'd be upset. Oh, what the hell, I went in, pulling the gate shut behind me. If something was going to happen, let it happen. If something wanted to happen, let it happen. I crossed the garden, scanning the area. My tennis shoes on the grass were as soundless as ever. There were several low fruit trees, the names of which I did not know, and a generous stretch of lawn. It was all overgrown now, hiding everything. Ugly passionflower vines had crawled all over 2 of the fruit trees, which looked as if they had been strangled to death. The row of osmanthus along the fence had turned a ghastly white under a coating of insects' eggs. A stubborn little fly kept buzzing by my ear for a time. Passing the stone statue, I walked over to a nested pile of white plastic lawn chairs under the eaves. The topmost chair was filthy, but the next one down was not bad. I dusted it off with my hand and sat on it. The overgrown weeds between here and the fence made it impossible for me to be seen from the alley, and the eaves sheltered me from the rain. I sat and whistled, and watched the garden, receiving its bounty of fine raindrops. At first I was unaware of what tune I was whistling, but then I realized it was the overture to Rossini's Thieving Magpie, the same tune I had been whistling when the strange woman called as I was cooking spaghetti. Sitting here in the garden like this, with no other people around, looking at the grass and the stone bird, whistling a tune badly, I had the feeling that I had returned to my childhood. I was in a secret place where no one could see me. This put me in a quiet mood. I felt like throwing a stone. A small stone would be okay, at some target. The stone bird would be a good one. I'd hit it just hard enough to make a little clunk. I used to play by myself a lot like that when I was a kid. I'd set up an empty can, retreat, and throw rocks until the can filled up. I could do it for hours. Just now, though, I didn't have any rocks at my feet. Oh well, nowhere has everything you need. I pulled up my feet, bent my knees, and rested my chin on my hand. Then I closed my eyes. Still no sounds. The darkness behind my closed eyelids was like the cloud-covered sky, but the gray was somewhat deeper. Every few minutes, someone would come and paint over the gray with a different textured gray, one with a touch of gold or green or red. I was impressed with the variety of grays that existed. Human beings were so strange. All you had to do was sit still for 10 minutes, and you could see this amazing variety of grays. Browsing through my book of gray color samples, I started whistling again, without a thought in my head.
"Hey,"
said someone. I snapped my eyes open. Leaning to the side, I stretched to see the gate above the weed tops. It was open, wide open. Someone had followed me inside. My heart started pounding.
"Hey,"
the someone said again. A woman's voice. She stepped out from behind the statue and started towards me. It was the girl who'd been sunbathing in the yard across the alley. She wore the same light blue Adidas t-shirt and shorts. Again, she walked with a slight limp. The one thing different from before was that she had taken off her sunglasses.
"What are you doing here?"
she asked.
Looking for the cat,
I said.
Are you sure? It doesn't look that way to me. You're just sitting there and whistling with your eyes closed. It'd be hard to find much of anything that way, don't you think?
I felt myself blushing.
It doesn't bother me,
she went on.
But somebody who doesn't know you might think you were some kind of pervert.
She paused.
You're not a pervert, are you?
Probably not, I said. She approached me and undertook a careful study of the nested lawn chairs, choosing one without too much dirt on it and doing one more close inspection before setting it on the ground and lowering herself into it.
And your whistling's terrible,
she said.
I don't know the tune, but it had no melody at all. You're not gay, are you?
Probably not, I said. Why?
Somebody told me gays are lousy whistlers. Is that true?
Who knows? It sounds like nonsense.
Anyway, I don't care even if you are gay or a pervert. By the way, what's your name? I don't know what to call you.
Toru Okada, I said. She repeated my name to herself several times.
Not much of a name, is it?
She said. Maybe not, I said. I've always thought it sounded like some pre-war foreign minister. Toru Okada. See?
That doesn't mean anything to me. I hate history. It's my worst subject. Anyhow, never mind. Haven't you got a nickname, something easier than Toru Okada?
I couldn't recall ever having had a nickname. Not once in my life. Why was that? No nickname, I said.
Nothing? Bear? Or frog?
Nothing.
Gosh,
she said.
Think of something.
Wind-up bird, I said.
Wind-up bird?
She asked, looking at me with her mouth open.
What is that?
The bird that winds the spring, I said. Every morning, in the treetops, it winds the world's spring.
Greek!
She went on staring at me. I sighed. It just popped into my head, I said. And there's more. The bird comes over to my place every day and goes creak in the neighbor's tree, but nobody's ever seen it.
That's neat, I guess. So anyhow, you'll be Mr. Wind-Up Bird. It's not very easy to say, but it's way better than Toru Okada.
Thank you very much. She pulled her feet up into the chair and put her chin on her knees. How about your name? I asked.
Mei Kasahara. May. Like the month of May.
Were you born in May?
Do you have to ask? Can you imagine the confusion if somebody born in June was named May?
I guess you're right, I said. I suppose you're still off school?
I was watching you for a long time,
she said, ignoring my question.
From my room, with my binoculars, I saw you going through the gate. I keep a little pair of binoculars handy for watching what goes on in the alley. All kinds of people go along there. I'll bet you didn't know that. And not just people, animals too. What were you doing here by yourself all that time?
Spacing out, I said. Thinking about the old days. Whistling. Mei Kasahara bit a thumbnail.
You're kind of weird,
she said. I'm not weird. People do it all the time.
Maybe so, but they don't do it in a neighbor's vacant house. You can stay in your own yard if all you want to do is space out and think about the old days and whistle.
She had a point there.
Anyhow, I guess Noboru Wataya never came home, huh?
I shook my head. And I guess you never saw him either after that, I asked.
No. And I was on the lookout for him, too. A brown-striped tiger cat, tail with a slight bend at the tip, right?
From the pocket of her shorts, she took a box of Hope regulars and lit up. After a few puffs, she stared straight at me and said,
Your hair's thinning a little, isn't it?
My hand moved automatically to the back of my head.
Not there, silly,
she said.
Your front hairline, it's higher than it should be, don't you think?
I've never really noticed.
Well, I have,
she said.
That's where you're going to go bald. Your hairline's going to move up and up like this.
She grabbed a handful of her own hair and thrust her bare forehead in my face.
You'd better be careful.
I touched my hairline. Maybe she was right. Maybe it had receded a bit. Or was it my imagination? Something new to worry about.
What do you mean?
I asked. How can I be careful?
You can't, I guess. There's nothing you can do. There's no way to prevent baldness. Guys who are going to go bald, go bald. When their time comes, that's it. They just go bald. There's nothing you can do to stop it. They tell you you can keep from going bald with proper hair care, but that's bullshit. Look at the bums who sleep in Shinjuku Station. They've all got great heads of hair. You think they're washing it every day with Clinique or Vidal Sassoon or rubbing Lotion X into it? That's what the cosmetics manufacturers will tell you to get your money.
I'm sure you're right, I said, impressed.
But how do you know so much about baldness?
I've been working part-time for a wig company quite a while now. You know I don't go to school, and I've got all this time to kill. I've been doing surveys and questionnaires, that kind of thing. So I know all about men losing their hair. I'm just loaded with information.
Gosh, I said.
But you know,
she said, dropping her cigarette butt on the ground and stepping on it.
In the company I work for, they won't let you say anybody's bald. You have to say, men with a thinning problem. Bald is discriminatory language. I was joking around once and suggested gentlemen who are follically challenged, and boy did they get mad. This is no laughing matter, young lady, they said. They're so damn serious. Did you know that? Everybody in the whole damned world is so damn serious.
I took out my lemon drops, popped one in my mouth, and offered one to Mei Kasahara. She shook her head and took out a cigarette.
Come to think of it, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
she said.
You were unemployed. Are you still?
Sure am.
Are you serious about working?
Sure am. No sooner had the words left my mouth than I began to wonder how true they were.
Actually, I'm not so sure, I said. I think I need time to think. I'm not sure myself what I need. It's hard to explain.
Chewing on a nail, Mei Kasahara looked at me for a while.
Tell you what, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
she said.
Why don't you come to work with me one day at the wig company? They don't pay much, but the work's easy and you can set your own hours. What do you say? Don't think about it too much. Just do it. For a change of pace, it might help you figure out all kinds of things.
She had a point there.
You've got a point there, I said.
Great,
she said.
Next time I go, I'll come and get you. Now, where did you say your house is?
That's a tough one. Or maybe not. You just keep going and going down the alley, taking all the turns. On the left, you'll see a house with a red Honda Civic parked at the back. It's got one of those bumper stickers, "Let there be peace for all the peoples of the world." Ours is the next house, but there's no gate opening on the alley. It's just a breeze block wall, and you have to climb over it. It's about chin height on me.
Don't worry. I can get over a wall that high, no problem.
Your leg doesn't hurt anymore?
She exhaled smoke with a little sighing kind of sound and said,
Don't worry. It's nothing. I limp when my parents are around because I don't want to go to school. I'm faking. It just turned into a habit. I do it even when nobody's looking. When I'm in my room all by myself, I'm a perfectionist. What is it they say? Fool yourself to fool others? But anyhow, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, tell me, have you got guts?
Not really, no.
Never had 'em?
No, I was never one for guts. Not likely to change, either.
How about curiosity?
Curiosity's another matter. I've got some of that.
Well, don't you think guts and curiosity are kind of similar?
Said Mei Kasahara.
Where there's guts, there's curiosity, and where there's curiosity, there's guts, no?
Maybe they are kind of similar, I said. Maybe you're right, maybe they do overlap at times.
Times like when you sneak into somebody's backyard, say?
Yeah, like that, I said, rolling a lemon drop on my tongue. When you sneak into somebody's backyard, it does seem that guts and curiosity are working together. Curiosity can bring guts out of hiding at times, maybe even get them going, but curiosity evaporates. Guts have to go for the long haul. Curiosity's like an amusing friend you can't really trust. It turns you on, and then it leaves you to make it on your own, with whatever guts you can muster. She thought this over for a time.
I guess so.
she said.
I guess that's one way to look at it.
She stood up and brushed off the dirt clinging to the seat of her shorts. Then she looked down at me.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, would you like to see the well?
The well? I asked. The well?
There's a dried-up well here. I like it. Kind of. Wanna see it?
We cut through the yard and walked around to the side of the house. It was a round well, maybe 4.5 feet in diameter. Thick planking, cut to shape and size, had been used to cap the well, and 2 concrete blocks had been set on the round wooden cap to keep it in place. The well curb stood perhaps 3 feet high, and close by grew a single old tree, as if standing guard. It was a fruit tree, but I couldn't tell what kind. Like almost everything else connected with this house, the well looked as though it had been abandoned long before. Something about it felt as if it should be called overwhelming numbness. Maybe when people take their eyes off them, inanimate objects become even more inanimate. Close inspection revealed that the well was in fact far older than the objects that surrounded it. It had been made in another age, long before the house was built. Even the wooden cap was an antique. The well surround had been coated with a thick layer of concrete, without a doubt to strengthen a structure that had been built long before. The nearby tree seemed to boast of having stood there far longer than any other tree in the area. I lowered a concrete block to the ground and removed one of the 2 half-moons that constituted the wooden cap. Hands on the edge of the well, I leaned over and looked down. But I could not see to the bottom. One could see it was a deep well, its lower half swallowed in darkness. I took a sniff. It had a slight moldy smell.
It doesn't have any water,
said Mei Kasahara. A well without water. A bird that can't fly. An alley with no exit. And Mei picked up a chunk of brick from the ground and threw it into the well. A moment later came a small, dry thud. Nothing more. The sound was dry, desiccated, as if you could crumble it in your hands. I straightened up and looked at Mei Kasahara. I wonder why it hasn't got any water. Did it dry up? Did somebody fill it in? She shrugged.
When people fill in a well, don't they fill it all the way to the top? There'd be no point in leaving a dry hole like this. Somebody could fall in and get hurt, don't you think?
I think you're right, I said. Something must have made the water dry up. I suddenly recalled Mr. Honda's words from long before. When you're supposed to go up, find the highest tower and climb to the top. When you're supposed to go down, find the deepest well and go down to the bottom. So now I had a well if I needed one. I leaned over the edge again and looked down into the darkness, anticipating nothing in particular. So, I thought, in a place like this, in the middle of the day like this, there existed a darkness as deep as this. I cleared my throat and swallowed. The sound echoed in the darkness, as if someone else had cleared his throat. My saliva still tasted like lemon drops. I put the cover back on the well and set the block on top of it. Then I looked at my watch. Almost 11:30. Time to call Kumiko during her lunch break. I'd better go home, I said. Mei Kasahara gave a little frown.
Go right ahead, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, she said. You fly on home.
When we crossed the yard, the stone bird was still glaring at the sky with its dry eyes. The sky itself was still filled with its unbroken covering of gray clouds, but at least the rain had stopped. Mei Kasahara tore up a fistful of grass and threw it towards the sky. With no wind to carry them, the blades of grass dropped at her feet.
Think of all the hours left between now and the time the sun goes down,
she said, without looking at me. True, I said. Lots of hours. 6. On the births of Kumiko Okada
and Noboru Wataya. Brought up as an only child, I find it difficult to imagine how grown-up siblings must feel when they meet in the course of their independent lives. In Kumiko's case, whenever the topic of Noboru Wataya came up, she would get a strange look on her face, as if she'd put some odd-tasting thing in her mouth by accident, but exactly what that look meant I had no way of knowing. In my own feelings towards her elder brother, there was not a trace of anything positive. Kumiko knew this and thought it entirely reasonable. She herself was far from fond of the man. It was hard to imagine them ever speaking to each other had the blood relationship not existed between them. But they were brother and sister, and this made things somewhat more complicated. After I had my argument with her father, and I severed all contact with her family, Kumiko had virtually no occasion to see Noboru Wataya. The argument had been a violent one. I haven't had many arguments in my life. I'm just not the type. But once I do get going, I go all the way, and so my break with Kumiko's father had been final. Afterwards, when I had got everything off my chest that I needed to, anger was mysteriously absent. I felt only relief. I never had to see him again. It was as if a great burden that I had been carrying for a long time had been lifted from my shoulders. None of the rage or the hatred was left. I even felt a touch of sympathy for the difficulties he had faced in his life, however stupid and repulsive the shape of that life might appear to me. I told Kumiko that I would never see her parents again, but she was free to visit them without me any time she wanted. Kumiko made no attempt to see them. "Never mind," she said. "I wasn't that crazy about visiting them anyway." Noboru Wataya had been living with his parents at the time, but when the argument started between his father and me, he had simply withdrawn without a word to anyone. This hadn't taken me by surprise. I was a person of no interest to him. He did his best to avoid personal contact with me unless it was really necessary. And so when I stopped seeing Kumiko's parents, there was no longer any reason for me to see Noboru Wataya. Kumiko herself had no reason to make a point of seeing him. He was busy, she was busy, and they had never been that close to begin with. Still, Kumiko would phone him from time to time at his campus office, and he would sometimes phone her at her company office, though never at our home. She would announce these contacts to me without detailing the substance of their conversations. I never asked, and she never volunteered the information unless it was necessary. I didn't care to know what Kumiko and Noboru Wataya were talking about, which is not to say that I resented the fact that they were talking, I just didn't get it. What was there for two such different human beings to say to each other? Or was it only through the special connection of their blood relationship that this came about? Though brother and sister, Noboru Wataya and Kumiko were separated in age by 9 years. Another factor behind the lack of any obvious closeness between the two was Kumiko's having lived for several years with her father's family. Kumiko and Noboru had not been the only children in the Wataya house. Between them, there had been a sister 5 years older than Kumiko. At the age of 3, however, Kumiko had been sent from Tokyo to distant Niigata to be raised for a time by her grandmother. Kumiko's parents later told her that this was done because she had been a sickly child, and they thought she would benefit from the clean air of the countryside. But she never quite believed this. As far as she herself could remember, she'd never been physically weak. She'd never suffered from any major illnesses, and no one in her Niigata home seemed especially concerned about her health. "I'm sure it was just some kind of excuse," Kumiko once told me. Her doubts had been reinforced by something she heard from a relative. Apparently, there had been a long-standing feud between Kumiko's mother and grandmother, and the decision to bring Kumiko to Niigata was the outcome of a truce they had concluded. By offering her up for a time, Kumiko's parents had quelled her grandmother's rage, and by having a grandchild in her possession, the grandmother had obtained concrete confirmation of her ties with her son, Kumiko's father. In other words, Kumiko had been a kind of hostage. "Besides," Kumiko said to me, "they already had 2 other children. Their 3rd one was no great loss to them.
Not that they were planning to get rid of me. I think they just figured it wouldn't be too hard on such a young child to be sent away. Probably they didn't give it much thought. It was just the easiest solution to the problem. Can you believe it? I don't know why, but they had not the slightest idea what something like that can do to a small child.
She was raised by her grandmother in Niigata from the age of 3 to 6. Nor was there anything sad or twisted about the life she led in the country. Her grandmother was crazy about her, and Kumiko had more fun playing with her cousins, who were closer in age to herself, than with her own brother and sister. She was finally brought back to Tokyo the year she was to enter primary school. Her parents had become nervous about the lengthening separation from their daughter, and they insisted on bringing her back before it was too late. In a sense, though, it was already too late. In the weeks following the decision to send her back, her grandmother became more and more overwrought. She stopped eating and could hardly sleep. One minute she would be hugging and squeezing little Kumiko with all her might, and the next she would be slapping her arm with a ruler, hard enough to raise welts. One minute she would be saying she didn't want to let her go, that she would rather die than lose her, and the next she would tell her to go away, that she never wanted to see her again. In the foulest language imaginable, she would tell Kumiko what a terrible woman her mother was. She even tried to stab herself in the wrist with a pair of scissors. Kumiko could not understand what was happening around her. The situation was simply too much for her to comprehend. What she did then was to shut herself off from the outer world. She closed her eyes. She closed her ears. She shut her mind down. She put an end to any form of thinking or of hoping. The next several months were a blank. She had no memory of anything that happened in that time. When she emerged, she found herself in a new home. It was the home where she should have been all along. Her parents were there, her brother and her sister. But it was not her home. It was simply a new environment. Kumiko became a difficult, taciturn child in these new surroundings. There was no one she could trust, no one she could depend upon unconditionally. Even in her parents' embrace, she never felt entirely at ease. She did not know their smell. It made her uneasy. She even hated it at times. In the family, it was only towards her sister that she began with difficulty to open up. Her parents despaired of ever getting through to her. Her brother hardly knew she existed. But her sister understood the confusion and loneliness that lay behind her stubborn moods. She stayed with Kumiko through it all, slept in the same room with her, talked with her, read to her, walked with her to school, helped her with her homework. If Kumiko spent hours huddled in the corner of her room in tears, the sister would be there, holding her. She did everything she could to find a way into Kumiko's heart. Had she not died from food poisoning the year after Kumiko returned from Niigata, the situation would have been very different.
"If my sister had lived, things might have been better at home," Kumiko said. "She was just a little girl of 11, but she was the heart of the household. Maybe if she hadn't died, all of us would have been more normal than we are now. At least, I wouldn't be such a hopeless case. Do you see what I mean? I felt so guilty after that. Why hadn't I died in my sister's place? I was no good to anybody. I couldn't make anybody happy. Why couldn't I have been the one? My parents and brother knew exactly how I felt, but they said nothing to comfort me. Far from it. They'd talk about my dead sister every chance they got, how pretty she was, how bright, how much everybody liked her, what a thoughtful person she was, how well she played the piano. And then they made me take piano lessons. Somebody had to use the big grand piano after she died. I didn't have the slightest interest in playing. I knew I could never play as well as she had played, but I didn't need yet another way to demonstrate how inferior I was to her. I couldn't take anyone's place, least of all hers, and I didn't want to try. But they wouldn't listen to me. They just wouldn't listen. To this day, I hate the sight of a piano. I hate seeing anyone play."
I felt tremendous anger towards her family when Kumiko told me this. For what they had done to her. For what they had failed to do for her. This was before we were married. We'd known each other only a little over 2 months. It was a quiet Sunday morning and we were in bed. She talked for a long time about her childhood, as if unraveling a tangled thread, pausing to assess the validity of each event as she brought it forth. It was the first time she told me so much about herself. I hardly knew anything about her family or her childhood until that morning. I knew that she was quiet, that she liked to draw, that she had long, beautiful hair, that she had 2 moles on her right shoulder blade, and that sleeping with me was her first sexual experience. She cried a little as she spoke. I could understand why she would need to cry. I held her and stroked her hair.
"If she had lived, I'm sure you would have loved her,"
said Kumiko.
"Everybody loved her. Love at first sight."
"Maybe so," I said. "But you're the one I happen to be in love with. It's really very simple, you know. It's just you and me. Your sister's got nothing to do with it." For a while, Kumiko lay there thinking. 7:30 on Sunday morning, a time when everything sounds soft and hollow. I listened to the pigeons shuffling across my apartment roof, to someone calling a dog in the distance. Kumiko stared at a single spot on the ceiling for the longest time.
"Tell me," she said at last. "Do you like cats?"
"Crazy about them," I said. "Always had one when I was a kid. I played with it constantly, even slept with it."
"Lucky you. I was dying to have a cat, but they wouldn't let me. My mother hated them. Not once in my life have I managed to get something I really wanted. Not once. Can you believe it? You can't understand what it's like to live like that. When you get used to that kind of life, of never having anything you want, then you stop knowing what it is you want."
I took her hand. "Maybe it's been like that for you till now, but you're not a kid anymore. You have the right to choose your own life. You can start again. If you want a cat, all you have to do is choose a life in which you can have a cat. It's simple. It's your right, right?" Her eyes stayed locked on mine. She said.
"Right."
A few months later, Kumiko and I were talking about marriage. If the childhood that Kumiko spent in that house was warped and difficult, Noboru Wataya's boyhood there was strangely distorted in another sense. The parents were mad about their only son, but they didn't merely shower him with affection, they demanded certain things of him as well. The father was convinced that the only way to live a full life in Japanese society was to earn the highest possible marks and to shove aside anyone and everyone standing in your path to the top. He believed this with utter conviction. It was shortly after I had married his daughter that I heard these very words from the man himself. "All men are not created equal," he said. "That was just some righteous-sounding nonsense they taught you in school. Japan might have the political structure of a democratic nation, but it was at the same time a fiercely carnivorous class society in which the weak were devoured by the strong, and unless you became one of the elite, there was no point in living in this country. You'd just be ground to dust. You had to fight your way up every rung of the ladder. This kind of ambition was entirely healthy. If people lost that ambition, Japan would perish." In response to my father-in-law's views, I offered no opinion. He was not looking for my opinion. He had merely been spouting his belief, a conviction that would remain unchanged for all eternity. Kumiko's mother was the daughter of a high-ranking official. She'd been raised in the finest Tokyo neighborhood, wanting for nothing, and she possessed neither the opinions nor the character to oppose her husband. As far as I could see, she had no opinion at all about anything that was not set directly in front of her, and in fact, she was extremely nearsighted. Whenever an occasion arose in which she needed an opinion on something in the wider world, she borrowed her husband's. If this had been all there was to her, she wouldn't have bothered anyone, but as is so often the case with such women, she suffered from incurable pretentiousness. Lacking any values of their own, such people can arrive at a standpoint only by adopting other people's standards or views. The only principle that governs their minds is the question, how do I look? And so, Mrs. Wataya became a narrow, highly strung woman whose only concerns were her husband's place in the government and her son's academic performance. Anything else ceased to have meaning for her. And so the parents pounded their questionable philosophy and their warped view of the world into the head of the young Noboru Wataya. They egged him on, providing him with the best tutors money could buy. When he took top honors, they rewarded their son by buying him anything he wanted. His childhood was one of extreme material luxury, but when he came to that most sensitive and vulnerable phase of life, he had no time for girlfriends, no chance to go wild with other boys. He had to pour all his energies into maintaining his position as number one. Whether Noboru Wataya was pleased to live that way or not, I do not know. Kumiko did not know. Noboru Wataya was not the sort of person to reveal his feelings. Not to her, not to his parents, not to anyone. He had no choice anyway. It seems to me that certain patterns of thought are so simple and one-sided that they become irresistible. In any case, Noboru Wataya graduated from his elite private preparatory school, majored in economics at the University of Tokyo, and graduated from this top institution with top grades. His father expected him to enter the government or a major corporation upon graduation from the university, but Noboru Wataya chose to remain in academe and become a scholar. He was no fool. He knew what he was best suited for, not the real world of communal action, but a world that called for the disciplined and systematic use of knowledge that prized the individual skills of the intellect. He did 2 years of graduate study at Yale before returning to the graduate school at Tokyo. He followed his parents' promptings, and a short time afterwards agreed to an arranged marriage. But that lasted no more than 2 years. After his divorce, he returned to his parents' home to live with them. By the time I met him, Noboru Wataya was a fully developed oddity, a thoroughly disagreeable character. About 2 years after I married Kumiko, Noboru Wataya published a big, thick book. It was an economic study full of technical jargon, and I couldn't understand a thing he was trying to say in it. Not one page made sense to me. I couldn't even tell whether this was because the contents were so difficult or the writing itself was bad. People in the field thought it was great, though. One reviewer declared that it was an entirely new kind of economics written from an entirely new perspective. But that was as much as I could understand of the review itself. Soon the mass media began to introduce him as a hero for a new age. Whole books interpreting his book appeared. Two expressions he had coined, sexual economics and excretory economics, became the year's buzzwords. Newspapers and magazines carried feature articles on him as one of the intellectuals of the new age. I couldn't believe that anyone who wrote these articles understood what Noboru Wataya was saying in his book. I had doubts whether they had even opened it. But such things were of no concern to them. Noboru Wataya was young and single and smart enough to write a book that nobody could understand. It made him famous. The magazines all came to him for critical pieces. He appeared on television to comment on political and economic questions. Soon he was a regular panel member on one of the political debate shows. Those who knew Noboru Wataya, including Kumiko and I, had never imagined him to be suited to such glamorous work. Everyone thought of him as the highly strung academic type, interested in nothing but his field of specialization. Once he got a taste of the world of mass media, though, you could almost see him licking his chops. He was good. He didn't mind having a camera pointed at him. If anything, he even seemed more relaxed in front of the cameras than in the real world. We watched his sudden transformation with amazement. The Noboru Wataya we saw on television wore expensive suits with perfectly matching ties and glasses with frames of fine tortoise shell. His hair had been done in the latest style. He'd obviously been worked on by a professional. I'd never seen him exuding such luxury before, and even if he had been outfitted by the network, he wore the style with perfect ease, as if he had dressed that way all his life.